Today we have an intern talk by Han Zhao. Han was an intern in our group. He was working as part of a bigger project on speech enhancement. So this project has been exciting, and we've had one more talk before this. So Han is from CMU. He is advised by Professor Jeff Gordon, and he is in the machine learning department, and he works on a variety of machine learning and neural networks, problems related to some product networks and a lot of other things. So today he will talk to us about how to use convolutional recurrent architectures to enhance speech signals. And I will hand over the floor to Han from here.
Thanks.
Welcome.
So today I will talk about speech enhancement with convolutional recurrent networks. And so let's start with the motivation. So why we need speech enhancement in the first place? So usually people care about acoustic speech recognition systems, and those systems are typically applied in two phases. The first one is the training phase, and the following one is the inference phase. So what people do in training phase is we collect a large amount of clean speech paired with corresponding transcriptions and feed the clean speech with transcription into a system, ASR system. The system then will be trained on this data. And after that, during the inference phase, the black box ASR system will be fixed. And it will be applied and it will be deployed in reality to in product. But the problem is when it was applied in practice, the noise collected from users usually contain a lot of noise. So this creates a problem like it's called distribution mismatch. What it means is the training data we have used to train the ASR system is different from the test data we see in practice. So how to relieve this problem is the focus of this study called speech enhancement. So more formally, the problem is like follows. So we are given noisy speech, and we want to find filters or function approximators such that after applying this function, that with input as noisy speech, we get clean speech as the corresponding output. So here's the outline of the talk today. So I will first give a very brief introduction to the background, like the pipeline of the speech enhancement system, and also the mathematical definition of like noisy and speech enhancement. Next, I will shortly describe related work using data-driven approach to the speech enhancement. And the third part is the main part of this talk, where I will introduce convolutional recurrent network for speech enhancement. So in the first part, I will also briefly discuss our preliminary results on combining clean speech to further improve speech enhancement using semi-supervised learning approaches. And finally, I will conclude the talk with some take-home messages, which hopefully will be useful for you. So let's start with the problem setup. So usually when we have, so here the small xt represents the clean signal we have in practice, and the epsilon t is the noise. It's the noise we observe. And the noisy signal is under this model is called additive noise model. It's the summation of these two signals. But usually to solve this problem, people make some statistical assumptions on the type of noise we observe. The two typical assumptions is the stationarity of the noise, which means the noise does not depend on time. It's assumed to be stationary at each time stage. The second one which is needed by classical approach to solve this problem is that we need to assume some specific type of noise we observe in the noisy signal. For example, a very simple assumption is that the noise we observe at each time step is a white Gaussian noise. And under those typical assumptions, people, have developed a closed form solution for the for speech enhancement under these assumptions, like a spectral subtraction, minimum mean squared estimator, or subspace approaches. But the problem with classical methods is that they are based on very strict statistical assumptions of noise. So on one hand, it's very simple, and it's computationally very efficient to implement the speech enhancement system under those assumptions. And we can also have some optimality guarantees under those assumptions. And the third point is it's highly interpretable, because we know exactly what the noise comes from and what type of noise we are encountered with. But the cons is also very obvious. The first is it's limited to only to stationary noise, which means that the noise cannot change a long time. The second one is those approaches can only deal with noise with a specific kind of characteristics, like white noise or pink noise, something related. So, but the question now is, what if we can collect a very large set of data, a large set of data sets with paired signals, meaning that for each noisy signal, we can also have its corresponding clean signal. So what if we can have a large amount of data set? The answer is we can probably using data-driven approach. Instead of making rigid assumption about the noise we observe, let's just collect large amount of data and fit models to learn a function approximator H. So more formally, the problem we are facing now is, so we are given a set of paired signals, x hat and x. Here, x hat means the noisy signal, and x means its corresponding clean signal. And our goal is to build function approximator h such that when h is input with x hat, h outputs its corresponding clean signal. And usually in practice, at least in Microsoft, the scale of data we are facing now is like the number of frames in our data set is like tens of millions. And the dimension of each frame is like around 256. Yes.
So where are you getting these paired signals? Are you generating those?
Are you taking
clean speech and adding noise?
Yeah, we have noise collected inside Microsoft. And then, So talking about data-driven approach, a first and obvious approach to solve this problem, since we are fitting a regression function, then why not using non-parametric regression, also known as kernel regression, to solve this problem? So the problem with kernel regression and the related approach is that the sample complexity grows exponentially in the dimension of our data. Here, the dimension is like 256, and the exponential of it is very large, which means we need very large data set for this kind of approach to converge. And the second problem is this computationally, those approach does not scale with the dimension of the data because there's a internal matrix inversion problem. And the third point, which I think is the most important one, is the non-parametric kernel regression does not try to exploit the relatedness between each task. Here, each task corresponds to a regression problem for one frequency bin in our data, but usually those frequency bins, they are highly correlated. But kernel regression approach cannot take advantage of these characteristics inside our problem. So another approach, which is parametric regression, we can use neural networks. So why neural networks may be a good idea here? So the first one is it's very flexible for representation learning, which means by choosing different structure of the network, we can decide the function basis we are going to use to approximate the optimal function H. The second one is it's very scalable. So it's linear in both the number of data, the size of the data set, as well as the dimension of our input data. And the third one is neural network provides us a very natural paradigm for multitask learning in the sense that we usually when applying neural network for functional approximation, we have two steps. The first step is to learn a basis function, which is a common representation for all the features. And the second problem is a simple linear regression. Here, here we have the different regression problems, but all those regression problems share the same representation. And this creates a natural task relatedness for this approach. Okay, before I introduce our model, so I will first list some related work in the literature, which also use data-driven approach with neural network to solve speech enhancement. So roughly there are two sets of different approaches. The first one is using recurrent neural network for denoising. I think it's from Stanford, Professor Andrew Ng's group in 2012. And the other line of methods using a general deep neural network, which is just multi-layer perceptron, to do frame-based denoising. So both of them use neural networks. The first one use sequential model, while the second one use frame-based denoising. Okay, so I will first introduce the pipeline we are going to use for our approach, but our talk is mainly focused on the second part. So every time we observe a signal in time domain, little xt, what we do is we first apply a short-term Fourier transform to transform the signal in time domain to frequency domain. Here, the capital X is actually a matrix where the first dimension is time, and the second dimension is frequency bin. So each one-dimensional time signal, small xt, is first transformed into a matrix, capital X. And we apply this procedure to both the noisy data and the clean data. So our paired input training data are matrices for each signal. And the second part of the pipeline is to build a neural network to approximate the denoising function H, such that with input X hat, which is the noisy spectrogram, it outputs the clean spectrogram capital X. And the third part of this pipeline is just to apply inverse short-term Fourier transform to convert the denoised spectrogram back into the time domain. This talk, I will mainly focus on this part, i.e. How we should design our neural network to better approximate the optimal function H. Okay, so let me repeat again the setup here. So what we have is a set of paired input data. Here the capital hat X is the spectrogram of the noisy signal, and the capital X is its corresponding clean version. Here both X hat and X, they are matrix with two dimensions. The first dimension is time. And the length of the signal can be different for different inputs, but the second dimension is the number of frequency bins we use in the frequency domain. So roughly, each signal has around 500 frames. And here I just show two examples of typical spectrogram we observe. The left one corresponds to the noisy spectrogram, and the right one is its corresponding clean spectrogram. So before I introduce our approach, there are two observations which is very intuitive and guide the design of our model for this problem. The first one is, so existing DNN-based approach do not fully exploit the structure of the problem at hand. So what I mean by this, So the first point is the frame-based DNN regression problem does not use the temporal locality of the signal. What I mean is, so say for example, let's check the clean spectrogram. It's clear that if we check this yellow line, it has a continuity along the time dimension. But if we use just use frame-based DNN regression problem to solve this problem, it may lose, because it does not have the context information, it cannot fully exploit the structure of the problem. One solution is to use context window, which means we not just do regression based on one frame, we can pad it with a context. But this creates another problem, how to choose the hyperparameter, I mean, how long the context window we should use. And for different signals with different kinds of noise, should we change the length of the context window, et cetera. But this problem can be potentially solved by using recurrent models. It will have the adaptive, it will have the power of using adaptive window size depending on the input signal. So the second problem is the spatial locality. So what I mean is DNN is a very generic problem. Also, we know that with enough power, which means with enough hidden neurons, every DNN can approximate any continuous function we are interested in. But this may require a large DNN to do so. But here, we have another clear observation that the spectral gradient itself is also continuous in the spatial domain, which means for two frequency bands which are continuous to each other, their local pattern should be similar to each other. So this suggests that in order to do regression based on spectrograms, we can probably treat the spectrogram itself as an image. So image have some local structure. So that's the reason why to solve image-related problem, people use convolutional neural network. Here, if we change our point of view to view each spectrogram again as an image, what it means probably means is we can first apply convolution neural network to spectrogram, and then also we take advantage of the temporal locality of this spectrogram to apply recurrent neural network.
So how, on the spatial locality here, you mean in the time frequency space, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because technically in audio, it is more direction in the real space when you use the spatial locality, but fine.
Yeah, what I mean is the frequency being they're highly correlated, okay. Yes.
Is there any condition between the speech signal and the noise, or is it totally independent?
They're independent.
And is there any periodic assumption of the noise? Or?
No, we don't make any assumption about noise. As I just explained, those two observations help us to design our model. So the first problem can be solved by using recurrent neural network. It has the advantage of using adaptive window size instead of using a fixed one. And the second problem can be solved using convolutional neural networks, because convolutional neural network is actually a sparse version of multi-layer perceptron, and it has less parameter to be trained, but it also take advantage of the structure of the problem. Okay, so before I introduce more details, I will first give a high-level introduction to the model we are going to use. So as I just say introduced before, it's an end-to-end approach. The input is the noisy spectrogram, and the output is its clean version. And in the intermediate, there are two parts. The first part is we apply convolution kernels to the noisy spectrograms. And after the convolution kernels, we feed the intermediate feature maps into a recurrent neural network. Here we use bidirectional LSTM. I will explain later why I choose this specific structure. And after we get the output of bidirectional LSTM, we just apply a very simple linear regression to regress from the intermediate feature map to the final output, which is the clean spectrogram. And the objective function here is very simple. We just use Frobenius norm, which is the mean square error between two matrix. And this is differentiable. We can use different kinds of optimization algorithm to optimize this objective function to find the best parameter for this model. So at high level, why we should expect this model to work well, because this model helps us to solve the two observations we just made, so which is the continuity of the spectrogram in both time and spatial domains. So convolution can be understood. I will make this point more clear later, but basically convolution neural network can be understood as local linear filters, which helps to capture local patterns in the spectrogram. And also, and the next is the bidirectional LSTM actually works as a flexible context window, symmetric context window, which means it can both take advantage of the previous frames and also the frames after. The last point is it's end-to-end learning system, and we don't make any assumption about the noise we observe or the signal we're going to deal with. What we require is just to is a large amount of paired data, and just feed the data to the system, let it run and optimize it. Here I will just give a very brief overview about what convolution actually does in here in our system. I know from the signal processing community, convolution, the definition of convolution is slightly different from the definition here I use. But actually, because the space we are going to deal with is symmetric, so basically, usually when people talk about convolution, they will first reverse the signal and do pointwise multiplication and then do summation. But here I just simplify it to be linear inner product, which means given a 2D image, let's say it's the large rectangle here is just an image, and I have a 2D kernel, which is the small square here. What I did is just align the small square to each part of the large rectangle, computing the corresponding inner product. So here we have a small convolution kernel with size B and W. B corresponds to the number of frequency bins the kernel covers, and the W corresponds to the context window this kernel covers. So when I align this small batch kernel to a small kernel to a batch, a local batch of the 2D matrix, I computing their inner product, and then I take a nonlinear transformation. Any question so far? No. Because this is slightly different from the original definition of convolution, the original definition will first transpose the convolution kernel and then do inner product. But since we are optimizing the kernels and that the space we are optimizing is symmetric, in the sense that if we can find a kernel W1 does the same thing, we can find a corresponding kernel W2, which is the transpose of W1, which gives the same result.
And this is when you do convolution in frequency domain with the complex values of the time frequency spectrum.
I use the...
Then we do complex conjugate and do multiplication and then summation.
Yes.
In your case, you work with the magnitudes only, so it's a real number, and this is completely valid definition for convolution in this case.
I think mismatching in convolution, what people usually did is, given two one-dimensional signal, the first thing to do is to reverse the convolution kernel and shift the kernel along the signal, mm-hmm. to pointwise summation. Mm-hmm. The signal itself can be complex or real, right?
That's correct, but in frequency domain, convolution becomes multiplication.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it matches the definition. You just don't do I50 back to get the...
That's right, yes.
That's fine.
Yeah.
It's not a huge contradiction.
So here I want to give a high-level idea of what convolution does is, because it actually computes the inner product, and the inner product is basically computing a similarity of local image batch to the convolution kernel. So we can effectively understand what convolution is doing is, it's like a local feature detector, and it detects a specific kind of patterns in the image. Here, the image corresponds to a spectrogram we have. And if the local pattern in the spectrogram matches our convolution kernel, then it has a large activation. Yes, so that's the high-level idea. And so what we do in our network is we first zero-pad the spectrogram in the time domain to make sure that after convolution, the feature map we get has exactly the same length as the original input. The reason why we need to guarantee that is because we need to feed the intermediate feature maps into a following by a recurrent neural network. And the output of the recurrent neural network should have the same length as the input.
So you're not doing any pooling?
I don't do any pooling. So here one convolution kernel will give us a corresponding feature map, but we can have many different convolution kernels. And what we do is we just concatenate all the feature maps together. Say each feature map is of size T and F prime. And if we have k different feature maps, we just concatenate together to get a large one. The size, the length of the time step is still T, but the size of the dimension of each feature map is k times the original size. So after we obtain the large feature map here, we just feed it into a bidirectional LSTM. So let's first ignore this part. It may look very scary, but basically what it does is very simple. It's a two-direction recurrent neural network, and each cell here corresponds to this complex diagram. So, but we don't need to understand every detail of this in this talk. So what required is just a LSTM cell is a special kind of recurrent neural net. And its advantage over traditional vanilla recurrent net is that it has a forgetting gate and the memory cell. And these two parts can help the system help the recurrent neural net to decide how large is the effective context window. That's the reason why we use LSTM. It's pretty standard in machine learning community now to use this specific structure. So after we obtain the output of BiLSTM, what we do is very simple. We just do a linear regression. So here, W times OT, where OT is the output at time step T of the BiLSTM. And we do a linear regression of it to get the final clean spectrogram. But here we have a restriction on the domain of the spectrogram. Spectrogram is guaranteed, is required to be non-negative. So we simply apply, this is a projection, but it coincides with the typical ReLU function. But here if we have different requirements of the range of spectrogram, say it has a lower bound of epsilon, we just need to change the zero here to be epsilon. It still corresponds to the optimal projection. And the final output is X tilter. Once we obtain X tilter, we just match it with the clean spectrogram and compute the corresponding Frobenius norm and apply optimization algorithm to solve it. The specific algorithm we're going to use here is Eta Delta, but people are free to use other kinds of algorithms. So I just introduced the system we're going to use. But in order to make it work in practice, we need to apply several tricks. So these tricks are what I found to be important in order to make it work in practice. I mean, the first one is orthogonal initialization of the hidden-to-hidden transition matrix of the recurrent neural network. The reason why we need to use this is to make sure that at the beginning of the optimization, the objective function does not blow up. The reason why we use orthogonal initialization is just to make sure all the eigenvalues are equal to 1, so that even the input sequence is very long, it does not blow up. The second one is learning rate scheduling. We decay the learning rate after 50 iterations. We multiplied by 0.1 every 50 iterations. And in our specific example, we find that using small batch size helps. The extreme case here is we use batch size 1. And also, it's quite important to choose the kernel size and its stride, because here the kernel size corresponds to the context window of the convolution and also the number of frequency bins it covers. Now, yep.
Before we continue to the data set, how will you do the training? So you have the convolutional part is clear. Once you determine the kernels, you just do the convolution and feed the BLSTM.
Yes.
And then after this, you have a regression.
Yes.
How will you do the training? First the BLSTM, then the regression, or you do this end-to-end?
I do this end-to-end.
Okay. Yes. Thanks. Because otherwise, it has an analytical solution, the regression part.
Yes, the linear regression has an analytical solution, yes. OK, so I'm going to introduce the experiment. So the specific data set we use here is a single channel Microsoft internal data set. And it's collected using Cortana. And the utterance contain both male utterance, female utterance, and children utterance. And the sampling rate we're going to use is 16K. And each utterance has around 5 to 9 seconds. And for this data set, we manually injected noise into the clean speech we have. We have 25 different types of noise with 377 different files. So the training data contains around 7,500 utterances. And we use the validation data set to the model selection, which means we, after each iteration of training, we check its performance on the validation set. Whenever validation error decreases, we save the model. So at the end of training, we have the best model on validation set. And we use the best model to do tests on the test set.
It says 25 types of noise. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you apply that? Do you change it every pass or every iteration? Or do you apply the different types of noise?
It's fixed. We first inject the noise into the clean speech, and after that, the data is fixed.
So do you use pipeline? Do you mix all the types together? I don't understand.
Each utterance of those 7,500 is mixed with given type of noise.
Okay.
One of the random.
So you sample from the
377.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
And one more component here. So the clean speech is also convolved with 48 room impulse responses to simulate the room reverberation, because we're talking far field speech enhancement here.
Okay, so before we compare our model with a state-of-the-art model in the literature, we first need to decide which specific model variant we're going to use. There are different hyperparameters to be decided here, like what's the size of the convolution kernel we are going to use, and how many hidden layers in LSTM, and how many different neurons in each layer of LSTM, etc. And also, I also try to inject some prior knowledge, formalize it using a regularizer to see whether those kinds of regularizer will help us or not. So the first factor we are going to investigate is whether there's a big difference between using single directional LSTM or bidirectional LSTM. Why this factor is important even in practice is if we decide to use bidirectional LSTM, the system is going to be offline, which means we need to first collect all the utterance. And then after we obtain the utterance, we can apply our model. But if we have the single directional LSTM, the system can be deployed in an online fashion, which means once we see a new frame, we can immediately output the corresponding clean frame. And here we use 9 different metrics to measure the performance of different models. So the signal-to-noise ratio, SNR, is quite typical. And also, we use the log spectral distance, LSD. Those three measures are based on the transcription of the corresponding signal And we also measure word error rate and the sentence error rate, but we don't optimize the following ASR system. The following ASR system is treated as fixed. And what we do is just we enhance our speech and see whether the enhancement will lead to an improvement in word error rate or sentence error rate or not. The final metric we're going to use is a perceptual evaluation of the quality of the speech. It's called PASC. So the first experiment we did is a comparison of single versus bidirectional LSTM. So what's the inference of symmetric context window versus a single directional causal context window? So on these two experiments, all the other model structures are treated as same. The only difference is for the first model, we only use a single direction recurrent net, and the second model use bidirection. And here the red N corresponds to the original noisy signal, and we don't do any enhancement to it. The green line here, C, corresponds to the clean signal we have. And the third line corresponds to the final result after optimization we obtain for the single direction and the bidirectional LSTM.
So does it mean that the single direction has 512 and one hidden layer?
So the single direction LSTM has only one hidden layer, and the hidden layer, the size of the hidden vector is 512.
Versus two hidden layers and 512.
Yes.
Are they consistent comparisons?
All the other are the same. The only difference is bidirectional, while the first one is single direction.
And the kernel is 11 frames, 32 frequency bins.
Yes. So the 11 corresponds to the width in the time domain, which means the context window, effective context window is 11. And the 32 corresponds to, it covers 32 frequency bins. We choose 32 because the total number of frequency bins is 256. And also the stride, which means how we move the convolution kernel in this image, we don't jump a long time.
But you move 16 frequency bins.
Yeah, I move 16 frequency bins along the frequency bin. I choose this number. I will show a comparison of this impact later. But the reason why is because the frequency bin, they're highly correlated with each other. Mathematically, we can also choose this number to be 1, but the result is the intermediate feature map will be very large. And there are a lot of redundant information in intermediate feature maps. So from the computational consideration, we choose a large jump here. So from this table, it's pretty clear that bidirectional LSTM dominates the single direction one. It's as expected, because we use bidirectional, effectively we has more information.
Do you mind if I ask a quick question?
Yes.
I don't understand the numbers. For example, if you look at the MSC number, is that mean square error?
It's mean square error in the time domain.
In SNR is also time domain SNR?
Yeah.
Yes.
In decibels.
In decibels. Then there's something that's a bit off, because from the noisy, let's say the first row, noisy, is 0.043. And then the single pass is 0.034. That is roughly a 7 dB improvement, but it shows going from 15 to 41.
Yeah, but they're not that related.
No, the MSC is in the time domain.
That's why I asked if the SNR is in the time domain as well.
We measured it in frequency domain, but it doesn't matter.
And there's a weighting function too.
So I'm missing something on the context. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a weighting that added to the SNR
calculation. Ah, okay. Sorry.
It's a
B weighting. Rico, this is basically one of the four interns in the SIP project. Mm. And we made sure that we have the same data set and the same measurement tool set for all four projects.
Yeah, because I see the main goal is the S versus B comparison, of course. Yeah. I just was trying to understand the raw data.
So the MSC I show here is measured in the final weight format. But the MSC I use.
Sorry to interrupt. sharp. So yeah. Is that like in the total waveform, or you measure MSC by frame
by frame,
in an
by frame.
Mean
by
per
frame.
So it's not in the total waveform.
Okay, so
that's
it's
another point we just missed.
Yeah, yeah. Which is segmental. We used to call that segmental.
Oh, segmental.
So you have segmental MSC, segmental SNR,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool.
But MSC I used in the optimization is in frequency domain. So it's pretty different.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a magnitude estimator.
Right, right. That's that. And also, if you don't mind, another quick question. Because since you do the spectral on the magnitude and you do the go through the deep neural networks and do the enhancement and the magnitude, when it comes time to synthesize back the sound, you need the phase.
Yeah.
Do you use the original phase?
I use the original phase from the noisy file.
Okay, which means there is noise in the phase.
Yes.
That wasn't processed.
That's right.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Just to double check.
Yeah.
It's common to do that. I just want to...
Yeah.
Okay.
We use the typical pipeline. Okay. Yeah. So from this experiment, we roughly see that bidirectional outperforms the single directional. And that the next experiment shows the inference of the size of convolution kernels on the final performance. So here, we did three different experiments. The first one is the first two using STRIDE11, which means there's it's very redundant in the frequency bin. But so the difference between these two is the window size of the first one is 5, but the window size of the second one is 1. Which means it's basically a 1D convolution. So the window size is 1, but the number of frequency bins is all the frequencies. So it's called 1D convolution, which is quite typical. And the first one is 2D convolution. The difference between the third experiment versus the first one is that I change the size of the window size, and I also make the stride along frequency bins larger. So the difference between the first and third is that it has less intermediate feature maps. The intermediate feature maps for the third one is smaller than the first one. Presumably, it should perform worse than the first one, but the large context window compensates for that. If we now compare the results we obtain here, we can see that except the LSD measure, for all the other measures, the third one outperforms the first one, which means that the impact of context window here, 11, is much more important than the stride. I mean, although it's quite crude here, I skip a lot in the frequency domain. But because the frequency domain, they're highly correlated, it doesn't lose too much information. Even if I use the stride 1-1, it's underperformance compared with the third one.
You have 2.66 in the previous slide.
Which one?
Where is the difference? 2.69 here?
Yeah.
11 by 32, where is the difference?
The size of the...
Oh, the number of kernels.
Different, yeah.
The number of kernels.
And also the size of the hidden layers.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So what we try to do is whenever we try to find parameters, keep all the other...
Yeah, keep all the other parameters fixed. It's a controlled experiment so that we can make sure the only difference is because of the factor we change. And also, this experiment shows what's the impact of how the number of feature maps, which corresponds to the number of convolution kernels, have on the final performance. So again, it's improved, but very slightly. Here, I doubled the number of kernels used in the experiment. But if we check the PASC and also the word error rate, the reduction is minimal. So in all the following experiments, our best model used 256 convolution kernels.
But this is still impressive. So 256 square rectangles.
Yes.
You describe the entire variety of the clean speech.
So each convolution kernel corresponds to a specific filter.
Uh-huh.
That just means I have 256 different filters.
Of size 11 by 32.
Yeah.
Did you plot them? How do they look?
No. It's not interpretable. Why?
Typically, when you use convolutional neural networks in image processing, you can clearly see the features.
That's not a feature of the convolution kernel itself. What people do in that case is they fine-tune the noise image what it means, it computes the gradient with respect to the input image, such that until it finds the largest activation for a specific convolution kernel. Do you see what I mean? It fine-tunes the input such to make the activation largest. So by that way, they interpret the convolution kernel as a detector for that batch. But actually, macro speaking, it's not.
So in this particular case, this is more time frequency filter than a specific image piece.
That's right, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
So we could also try to do that and try to find the highest activation for
That will be interesting to see which of those 256 key components in the speech.
Yeah. So you're doing all the hyperparameter tuning on really the training data, right? You haven't like brought in any new real world speech with different noise?
No. I use the same training validation test set.
Yeah. And just to be clear, the data we are using is still real world data. The Cortana data was from real speakers, and the noise recorded was also in real from the environment. There's nothing synthetic here.
Yeah, I'm just curious how it behaves on data other than that noise and that speech.
Yeah, it has results of that, I think.
And again, this experiment shows so the difference between this experiment and the previous one is I want to see what if I further increase the stride of the kernel size along frequency bins to see whether it has a serious degrade. And if we compare these two. But on the other hand, I compensate for the hidden size of the hidden layer and see roughly they are the same. And this also helps me to decide the optimal model at the end I'm going to use to compare with the state-of-the-art results. This one investigates, so what's the choice? What's the optimal choice for this particular data set? I mean, how many hidden layers we should use? And I do three experiments, corresponds to using 1, 2, 3 hidden layers in the BioSTM. Again, all the other hyperparameter are treated as fixed, so the difference can only be explained by the depth of the BioSTM. So originally, I would expect the third one to perform the best, but unfortunately, it doesn't. I attribute the reason to the difficulty of optimization for deeper recurrent nets. For this experiment, the first and second two, they are comparable to each other. The second one slightly better in terms of pass. And that's the reason why I picked two hidden layers at the end.
Can I ask another one quickly? PASC usually correlates reasonably okay with perceptual feeling.
Yeah.
And a 0.5 difference as you're getting there compared to the noisy should be noticeable.
Yes.
So when you listen to the reconstructed waveforms, do they sound?
Yeah. I will show a case study. I have a case study for all the state of the art model as well as ours.
All right.
Yeah. Cool. And so another factor we want to see is whether the current model overfits our data. To see this, I use dropout, which is a quite standard technique to avoid overfitting in the deep learning literature. So I used 4 different dropout rate to see the performance change a lot or not. If the performance change a lot, that means our current model may overfit the data. But from the experiment's result, again, all the other factors hyperparameter are the same. But the difference, I mean, I didn't see a clear winning model for those 4 different experiments, which means that for this data set, our current model does not overfit the data. And that's the reason why, at the end, I don't use dropout for the optimal architecture. The final experiment I want to describe here is the effect of using our prior knowledge to add it into our objective function. For all the previous experiments, I only use the Frobenius norm as our objective function. But one thing I think during my experiments is that the output clean signal should be continuous in time. That's the observation I made. So I manually add a temporal difference regularizer into the objective function to enforce every two consecutive frames should be close to each other. And I add this regularizer into the original objective function and do the experiments again. So those two experiments, they use exactly the same model. The only difference is the first one does not use the original MSE error, while the second one adds this temporal regularizer. And when I see the final result, it seems that adding this temporal regularizer decreased the performance.
You try to smooth the spectrum? No, this doesn't work.
Right, I try to smooth the clean spectrogram, but it doesn't help.
It's been tried many times in more crude and naive way, but no.
Why? Because I see the image of clean spectrogram, it's continuous in time.
It looks like continuous in time, and it may be if we have a frame step of, let's say, 1, 2, 4 milliseconds. We jump every 16 milliseconds, and this is already creates enough difference. Yes, it is continuous as a traces, but not only across the time. It may go across the time frequency. When you have a 4 month frequencies, they may move diagonally.
Oh yes, they may move diagonally. That's what I see in the figure.
And the smoothing sometimes hurts the pattern of the diagonal motion, and it creates minor artifacts that are pretty good at detecting. Mm-hmm. And PASC will capture some of that as well.
I do see a degrade in most of the metric.
It's not too much surprising.
It's quite surprising to me. I don't have the prior knowledge of this.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, the last one is just to decide what's the hyperparameter for the number of neurons in each layer. And also by doing this experiment, I find my best model I'm going to use to compare with the other state-of-the-art results. So the fourth experiment here corresponds to the optimal model I found and which will be used later. It has two hidden layers, and each hidden layer has 1,024 hidden neurons. Now, I use 256 convolution kernels, each with size 11 context window and the 32 frequency bins. And the stride is, again, 117. And the fourth line here, clearly it achieves on 8 out of 9 metrics, it achieves the optimal result. And actually, if we compare the word error rate, it's the first time that we see an improvement in word error rate without doing anything to the ASR system we're going to use. So for all the other experiments which I performed so far, after speech enhancement, the word error rate actually hurts. But this one sees a slight improvement, around 1% improvement. And the PASC is like 0.6 improvement. Okay, so for all the previous experiments, I perform it to choose the best model and to see what's the impact of different hyperparameters of the model architecture on the final performance. Since I already have the optimal one, I would like to compare it against the state-of-the-art results in the literature. So the first one I'm going to compare with is the classic noise suppressor currently used in Microsoft product teams. And the second one is the DNN-based regression for denoising. Here, the symmetric means I use a context window of 11, and the constant window is symmetric, which means I have 5 frames preceding the current frame and 5 frames following the current frame. The third one is DN symmetric log. I use log because In this paper, they describe that using log spectrum instead of spectrum further improves the performance. So as a fair comparison, I use exactly the same setting here. And the third one is again a DNN-based approach. But instead of using a symmetric context window, in this experiment, so the context window is causal, which means I only use 6 frames preceding the current one.
Previous.
Yeah, so 7 frames altogether. For the last one, I use a deep RNN. Again, I use exactly the same structure, the same optimal structure described in this paper, which has three hidden layers, and each layer has 500 hidden neurons, and it's a single direction RNN.
At this point, are you starting to use a different data set or still the same?
Still the same. So here's the result compared with all the previous state-of-the-art approaches I just described. So the first one is the current tool we used in the product team. And the DNS corresponds to DNS metric, DNC corresponds to DNN causal. SL, DNSL is DNS metric, but with log spectrogram. RNN is from Stanford. So we see that, so for all the metrics, we achieved the best. And
can
for,
I double check something with you? Is that the ER word error rate on
yes.
a speech recognizer?
Yes.
So we use the Bing speech recognizer.
Okay. Which is not necessarily a reference, but it's still it's something. These numbers are strange, right? All the DNNs
yes.
have such a bad WER.
That's right. This is what
yeah.
I achieved. And also,
they all reduce fast, which is weird.
Unfortunately,
yes.
none of these papers talk about WER. They only talk about best.
And also,
it's the first time you probably evaluated.
So it is very common.
Which is weird from a Cortana perspective that WER is incredibly important, right?
It is very common in the speech community to state that we don't need speech enhancement because we do multi
condition
learning.
Every time you try to
training.
Enhance, you actually hurt.
And this is why, and in general, that you look at those 55, 54, 60, 44. Those used to be lower back in the times of HMM-based speech recognizers. Apparently, the DNN-based speech recognizers, they handle the work area best, but outside of that, they just collapse. And the other thing, one more, this MS is the speech recognizer which was optimized on a data set for speech recognition. You see, we don't get much noise suppressor, we don't get much PESC.
But look at the WR.
Yes, that was the optimization.
Yeah, I will see. I will show some case studies to see why this
okay.
has those problems.
Yeah, the MS doesn't actually improve SNR that much, but on the other hand, it holds WR well.
Yeah. So once we see the spectrogram, we will understand why. So here so I show the spectrogram of both noisy, clean, and the corresponding the MS Cortana tool. So you see that by checking the spectrogram, the current tool does not do speech enhancement very progressively, actively. So, but on the other hand, it doesn't hurt WER too much. That probably just means that doing nothing, I mean, is the best. But let's listen to the audio first. First, I will show the noisy audio.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
And also the clean one.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
And let's listen to the MS.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
Pretty much the stationary part of the noise, actually making the background noises and voices way more audible.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, that's
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, but this is what you can expect. This is a very classic noise suppressor.
Yeah. But I think it had room to do more because there was no musical noise on the MS Cortana.
Yeah,
there was a little bit of spectral
with
swish.
With TDB noise suppression, what you
yes,
expect?
That's true. Then that's not enough.
So this was very indicative, actually. During the optimization process, the optimization made the noise suppressor enormously low aggressive, trying to minimize the work error rate.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So if we check the spectrogram of the DNN, we see that it doing enhancement very progressively, which means
that's gonna stop.
Okay. Yeah. You see, it loses all the frequency.
Which DNN is this?
Huh?
Which DNN is this?
It's DNN symmetric 11 context window.
Okay.
And then let's listen to the.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
So you just decided that If you cut everything above 3000 hertz, it will be better.
Yeah.
Among other things, did a little good low pass filtering. but you see the structure that may have to do a little bit your comment on regularization. You do end up with a little bit of an artificial structure, right? In the DNA reconstruction.
There was no regularization.
There's no regularization.
What I'm saying is that in the same way that a little bit of artificial structure sounds funny, if you try to regularize, it may actually contribute to artificial structure. And it does sound funny.
I see. And the third one is the RNN from Stanford.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
It's overly aggressive. You see how much of the actual speech it cut.
Yeah. And the last one.
It did a nice job of preserving the S's, right? Mm. The S's sounded.
See above the S.
Yeah, and you see above how they're there, yeah.
The last one is ours.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
Yeah, but it also contained the background noise from baby. But if you check the RNN one,
who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
We almost do not hear the baby noise.
Yeah, but on the other hand, the distortion to the actual speech is significant, right?
Yeah,
yours has much less distortion.
Yeah, so.
Who are the Seahawks playing this Sunday?
What was on the first slide?
The first slide?
Yes.
It's the noisy one.
Okay.
Do you want to listen again?
The second was?
The clean one, the corresponding clean
and this
one.
This was the classic
message. Yes, can you show the second slide?
Second one?
Yes.
The DNA?
DNN was the cut. The third one is RNN with the distortions. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? One thing that comes to mind, I don't know if that makes any sense, if you don't mind my making a comment, mm-hmm. is that since you took a lot of the more raw noise, but the baby's voice was still left together with the girl making the speech, it seems that at the end you end up with almost two sources. There's the person speaking and another person like the baby making
yeah.
noise, which means if you were to, just for fun, try to feed that to a blind deconvolution or a blind source separation that tries to separate two sources from that. But because you did all the cleanup of all of the junk that tends to mess up with a blind source separation, I wonder if that as an input to a blind source separation could actually produce, if it could actually remove some of the baby and get
in
back to place. I'm not sure, it's just to share with you, kind of came to mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you try feeding this through again to see what happened? Just curious.
This one?
Yeah, feed that signal through a second time, see if they're not doing
it. I'm not sure.
What's the question?
Just take this.
Who are the Seahawks?
Yeah, take that and feed it through your
Sunday.
Whole network again.
Feed it
to the
network.
This also has been tried many times.
Yes,
no,
feed it back to the network.
Guaranteed that result.
I don't know.
Okay.
Actually, I don't know. Yeah.
And then, and actually, on things that are kernel based, that tends to give you back the same thing, right? So
okay.
The second pass already doesn't do much or hurts,
or hurts.
As Yvonne's expecting.
I
In
guess.
In general, further. Extension of your idea, Rico, is to add the sounds of separation into the neural network itself, asking to produce two outputs and to maximize the statistical dependence.
I see. Instead of trying
just
to do two steps. Yeah.
Yeah.
That might actually make sense. Yeah.
During the training.
I see. Yeah. But that is kind of tough because you're making a hard assumption that there are two sources, which we can say that after listening. And we're using all of our brain to conclude that there's probably two sources. But in real world, how many sources would be the right number, right? Then now you have yet another hyperparameter that is costly.
No, in general, overly aggressive, because think about this. The speech recognizer will recognize that it's not the speech. because it won't fit the phonemes, and it will ignore it. If you make it more aggressive, you'll cut the baby crying, but you'll cut important information
that important.
That's important for the speech.
That is
I'm completely fine with less aggressive noise suppressor, which brings better PESC and better speech recognition results.
Makes sense.
So we finished the first part of the talk, which is the model design. Find the best model for speech enhancement. The second topic I'm going to discuss about is whether can we further boost the performance of speech enhancement by using only clean speech from timid data. Here I call it semi-supervised learning with clean signals. So the setting here is, besides the supervised paired data set we have, additionally we have unlabeled data, which corresponds to the clean speech from timid. And I want to investigate, is there a way to incorporate this part of clean data into the existing system to further improve the result? So here, a very straightforward way to try in the first place is to use the clean speech to do pre-training of the model. And then after pre-training, we just apply the supervised learning we just described in before. So here, I again do two experiments. And the only difference between these two experiments is in the baseline, we don't do any pre-training. But for the second experiment, I use timid data to do pre-training, in the sense that the input of the network is the clean speech, and the output should also be the clean speech. And by doing this, effectively, we are using our neural network, instead of doing speech enhancement, it's doing recurrent autoencoder, which tries to preserve the clean speech. Okay, but surprisingly...
So hold on. You train timid, clean.
Yes.
And then without any further training, you go and do the processing of your training.
No.
Or you train
after I do the autoencoder using timid pre-training, I again use the Cortana data.
Which means a better starting point,
yes.
Point for your optimization.
Yes. Okay. So I should make it clear. If the model itself is convex, then it doesn't matter. Clearly, pre-training does not help.
Yeah.
It will only help to fast convergence.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best we can hope. But since neural network is non-convex, it's not clear whether pre-training will bring it into a better local optimal or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I do this experiment. But unfortunately, it hurts the performance a lot by using timid data to do pre-training in the first place. You see, it's almost 0.2 degrees in PESC. The model itself are exactly the same. So the second one, so from this experiment, we conclude that pre-training fails, in this case, to use unlabeled data. For second one, what we do is we use a hierarchical denoising autoencoder. What does that mean? Let me explain to you. So suppose we have, let's first ignore the second part. Traditional frame-based DNN denoising, just the input noisy signal, and the output, the predict signal, and do regression with the clean one. But besides doing so, we can make it hierarchical denoising in the following sense. In each training phase, I input both the noisy signal and the clean signal, but they go through exactly the same structure. After each nonlinear transformation, I get intermediate representation of both signals, both clean and the noise. And I add the corresponding MSE loss into the final objective function.
So literally, you tell the network at each stage with the noisy signal to be as close to the clean signal
as
possible.
Yes, exactly. So that's the hierarchical denoising autoencoder version. I draw two parts here. They share exactly the same network. And by doing this, we can also utilize the timid clean data in the following way. So the clean signal here is, again, the clean timid data. But for a noisy one at each layer, I manually inject the white Gaussian noise. So that's the way I try to also use timid data in this structure. And here is the results we obtain. You see, there are two differences between these two experiments. The first one is So the edge experiment here tries to use TIMIT with injected white Gaussian noise, and also use the intermediate MSE loss, which enforce the model to be a hierarchical denoising architecture. So these are the two major differences. But the model itself, the number of neurons, number of different layers are fixed to be same. But again, we see a serious degrade in performance. So for all the experiments I did so far, it seems every time I want to incorporate my prior knowledge about this task, hurts the final performance. The best way to achieve the best performance is simply end-to-end learning without any additional assumption or additional prior about the underlying task. It seems every time I want to inject regularizer, it hurts the performance a lot. The third try we made is to use mixture models to help using the unlabeled data. So here, what we do is we try to use the unlabeled data to create different clusters of the input frame, and then we partition our noisy data into different clusters and build different models for different data sets. The only difference between those four different experiments is that I use different data to create cluster at the first place. For second experiments, I use noisy Cortana data to create cluster center. For third one, I use clean Cortana data. And for the last one, I use clean TIMIT data. And let's see the result. So as we can check, using mixture model indeed helps boost the performance, I mean, quite uniformly. If we compare the last experiments, which use clean TIMIT data, compared with the first one. But also, again, if I just use the noisy or clean Cortana data to create a mixture model, I also see an improvement over the baseline. So, which means that using mixture model indeed helps on speech enhancement, but the source of success is not due to the clean TIMIT data. It's due to the more complex, more powerful mixture model. Okay, so I think I finished the two major parts of my talk. So a brief conclusion of the whole talk. So I would say the convolution recurrent neural network is especially good for speech, is very good for speech enhancement, because the convolution and the recurrence help to capture the structure of our data along both the time domain and also the frequency domain. And our model on the Cortana data set achieves an improvement of past 0.6 on average, and also without fine-tuning the following ASR system, we improve the word error rate by 1%. I would imagine we can make it larger if we have a larger amount, even larger amount of data. And for the second part, the semi-supervised learning using TIMIT data, so far we don't see a successful approach to use the clean TIMIT data to further boost the performance. But I would, from the third experiments here, I would see using mixture or ensemble model combined with the convolutional recurrent neural network will achieve even further improvement. That's it, the end of my talk.
Cool.
Thanks. Any questions?
Can I make a quick comment? I was
surprised
by the auditory quality, and I have fiddled with noise suppressors for a long time, and I'm doing simple things like without any machine, core machine learning thing, doing just simple adaptive filters and spectral subtraction and things like that. You end up fighting with musical tones and other things like that, and you didn't have any noticeable. There's also the spectral components that go in and out and produce the typical whooshing effect, and you have very little of that, which is also interesting. And I would suggest that the particular example that you chose to show us in terms of playing sounds and all that, that is cool. It would be nice, because that's still something that bugs my head to this date, since doing some experiments, you know, 30 years ago, which is you play the noisy and you play the enhanced one. And in some cases, including yours, this particular clip may not show, but other clips may show that when you play the enhanced one, it is actually easier for a person to understand what is said. Which means that if you have that feeling, it means that to some extent, the word error rate or the fatigue rate for the human brain got improved. So how come the WR on the speech recognition didn't get improved?
All the reasons he said,
time?
Right? I mean, it's constrained
right.
on data.
It's right. So, but the fact that it actually improves to a person, it's a significant thing. Because it means usually, I remember when I was at PictoTel doing things like conference analysis, there's this fatigue factor when you have too much reverberation or too much noise. And if a clip shows that you feel a bit more comfortable listening to it, then the fatigue factor, after 2 hours, let's say, of being in a meeting where you have to try to understand, maybe the fatigue would go down. So it might be interesting that if you have some clips that give that impression that it is a little easier for a person to understand, It might be cool to actually, with the HCI guys, run a fatigue experiment. Because if you show a reduction in fatigue, that is actually another metric that is rarely discussed. But I remember in the video conferencing business, people would complain to us. That's why, for a typical example, is why they pay extra money to do wideband instead of telephone quality. Because that's very easy to measure. Fatigue on telephone quality is very high. Fatigue on wideband is not that high. And we would say, well, it costs you $3,000 more to have wideband. Everybody paid. Because they knew that you get tired of a two-hour meeting on telephone quality, and it improves quite a bit on wideband. That's too obvious, because obviously it's a huge difference in bandwidth. But here, on the actual speech quality and being less noisy, if it improves fatigue, it could actually be something that you could sell to Skype and say, look, besides Cortana, if it's not a WER play, but it's a fatigue play, it's something that Skype could be interested in.
Oh, these are very good comments.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to address what you said in the beginning about using classic suppression techniques to optimize musical tones and stuff, right? I think they have their own, in my opinion and my experience after all this, I think they have their own benefits. I think the major benefit those techniques bring in is generalizability. So this falls on its face, or it suffers quite heavily when you put it in an unknown situation or under noise conditions which the model has not seen, right? So it becomes very difficult for it to adapt, or as well as to train it. So it takes a lot of time.
It's not just like a two parameters that
exactly.
you quickly learn.
Yeah.
And also, I guess one of the reasons why the WER drops after speech enhancement is because after the enhancement, the distribution of signal is different from the training of the ASR system.
That is exactly how I remember conversations with Alex, who used to do that, and he would say exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You messed up the PDF, so no matter what the machine learning engine I'm doing now, I'm mismatched.
Yes.
But a good question would be, if you do speech recognition on the noisy data, to some extent, that machine learning engine has learned that. Now, retrain the speech engine with enough samples of your enhanced thing, and now run through that.
Yeah.
Could you then get an improvement?
I would expect.
And
I would expect.
The answer might be yes. And if yes, then it's a good thing to do.
Yes.
We did this with Kinect.
Ah, right. And
even
it was yes, right?
Even today, when you download KDK, there is a Kinect acoustical model which was tangent on the output of the pipeline.
So, yeah.
But it was a little bit more complicated. So first we trained the audio pipeline using PASC and speech recognizer trained on clean speech with the clean speech model. So literally the speech recognizer was another quality measure, distance measure between the clean speech and the output of the. Once this happened, we run against, we retained the speech recognizer, got the new acoustical model, and we then saw a substantial drop in the word error rate with the new acoustical model. So we tried it one more time, but this time we didn't get any improvement.
So I wonder if with the new cognitive services, if they allow you to, without that much work, retrain the engine. Because if so, that would be a natural extension in terms of experiments to just at least try and see what happens.
So they have a reconfigurable, retrainable service. I think we should try that.
Oh, that's
Cool. But look, if you do that, then the real solution is merge this with the front end of the speech recognizer and train in bulk with the noisy speech.
Yeah,
potentially, but at least you would have an avenue to enhance the final performance. Right?
So overall, I feel like one of the biggest hurdles to adoption of this technique is operating in unknown conditions.
Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest challenges I think the whole community should work on.
Right? Yeah.
Because people have worked on using
problems.
Yeah.
I mean, in machine learning, there's a specific area, domain adaptation or transfer learning to do this.
Yeah, so that's probably where I think people should put effort in. This kind of is almost a solved problem, in my opinion, or near to be solved.
But this is pretty cool. I mean, I was coming to the lecture thinking, one more paper, one more presentation on noise reduction. It's going to be full of artifacts. I was surprised. It sounded pretty good.
We have two more exciting projects.
This is the second of the four talks.
Ah, all right.
This is one of the guys, and the other one is...
So I need to come to the audience as well. But they're not now, are they?
No, not today.
September.
Ah, okay. So I'll come to those as well.
Cool. Thanks for all the suggestions.
So let's thank...